When I was in fifth grade, I lived in France. Because of my dad's job as a European politics expert, I spent the entire year living in Bordeaux, France, in the southwest of the country, attending a Catholic school there. When I came back to Oregon and was thrust into middle school, the first time I'd ever gone to a school where every class was taught by a different teacher and students were trusted to just walk between classes, a lot of the teachers would good-naturedly tease me about school in France. They'd ask me things like, did you have to wear a beret as part of your uniform? No, we didn't even have uniforms at all. Did you have croissants in your school cafeteria? No, because croissants are considered cheap snack food. French school cafeterias serve high cuisine. Did your classmates say ooh la la at everything? They do actually say that. Every generation has their own specific use of ooh la la, but among young French women, it's kind of like the French equivalent of sks. Did they let you drink wine? No, but I do remember a time when the school cafeteria served baba au rhum, a little cake soaked in rum, as dessert after lunch, in an elementary school. Oh, and was everyone obsessed with Jerry Lewis? This was a new one. What did Jerry Lewis have to do with France? Who even was Jerry Lewis, anyway? I was into early rock and roll in those days, so the first thing I thought was Jerry Lee Lewis, that 50s rhythm and blues piano man who married his 13-year-old cousin? And my teacher said no, Jerry Lewis. So I was born in 2001. It's not like I could be expected to know who Jerry Lewis was, but I eventually found out that he was a slapstick comedian from the mid-20th century. He was a mainstay on movie marquees from World War II all the way through to the Reagan era, and he made millions but was much maligned by critics. If you were born after 1980, you probably don't know who Jerry Lewis was. But if you were born before then, you definitely do. As I discovered in middle school, one of the oldest and weirdest American stereotypes about French people is that they're obsessed with Jerry Lewis. Throughout the period when Jerry Lewis was big, there was sort of a running joke among American critics, who were no fans of Jerry Lewis, about how the French considered Lewis's movies great cinema. There was a lot of mocking of the otherwise prim, snobbish, and anti-American French for enjoying Lewis's lowbrow comedies. It's very uncharacteristic of them, very out of whack with all the other American stereotypes of French people, which is why it was so much fun to believe.
Quiet, Harry, quiet. I think he's trying to tell us something.
Annie, come on, Annie.
Whack, 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 whack,
I've spent a fair amount of time in France since then as well, and I can confirm I've never heard a French person say anything, positive or negative, about Jerry Lewis. But to this day, you'll find occasional articles from fairly respectable American media outlets asserting that yes, it's not a myth, the French really do love Jerry Lewis. In 2014, Vanity Fair ran an article where they interviewed a bunch of people in line for a Paris screening of Lewis's unfunny 1963 smash hit, The Nutty Professor. They seemed to use the existence of this line as evidence for France's Jerry Lewis love fest, but later in the article admitted that the theater was only about a third full. You could find enough Jerry Lewis fans to fill a third of a theater in any major city. In 2017, though, when Lewis finally died, the New York Times made a much more convincing case for the truth in the pre-memes meme of Jerry Lewis being treated as a serious filmmaker in France. They quoted a comment from the Minister of Culture in the French government, remembering Lewis as someone who was better understood in France than in his home country. French TV channels were changing their programming to run Jerry Lewis marathons. Lewis's death had even made the front page of the widely circulated national newspaper Libération, with the simple headline, Génie Lewis, Lewis the Genius. Now, this was evidence that there was something to this after all. Maybe it was a previous generation that really loved Jerry Lewis, but at some point, Lewis really had been more revered and taken more seriously in France. So, why did baby boom era French people love Jerry Lewis? That's a little bit harder to answer, But I will say this, it's less uncharacteristic for the French than you think. Yes, they're snobs. Yes, they have a superiority complex over Americans, but they also have a soft spot for a certain idea of Americana. They love cowboys and Indians stories. The best-selling French musician of all time was a rock star called Johnny Hallyday, birth name Jean-Philippe Smet, who was known for riding into his concerts on a motorcycle and playing terrible French covers of American blues rock standards. Hallyday was more Jerry Lee Lewis than Jerry Lewis, but given that the French seemed to be big fans of trashy imitations of American music in the 1950s and 60s, it's not a surprise that they were fans of trashy American movies too. But there's more to Jerry Lewis's French reputation than that. He wasn't remembered as the nation's goofy uncle, he was remembered as a genius. His movies were seen as art. I think at least part of it is that the French love an auteur. Like a less funny Tommy Wiseau, Lewis was usually the writer, director, producer, and star of his movies. He had complete control over his movies, which I think automatically got French people to see his movies as artists' visions rather than big studio tentpoles. The French respected the effort he put into his visual gags and understood that those things take effort, a lot more than Americans understood that. The Nutty Professor, which is a slapstick retelling of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, got attention from French academia either as an illustration of mid-century American cultural fears or as a self-deprecating, backhanded attack on Lewis's old comedy partner, Dean Martin, and this was decades before it became common for scholars to analyze mainstream movies. But there was a time when it seemed Jerry Lewis was on the verge of being respected as a serious artist on both sides of the Atlantic, when this most lowbrow of comedians could have made a leap into drama. If Jerry Lewis had successfully finished the project we're going to talk about in this episode, he might have been revered as a dramatic filmmaker, and his long career in slapstick would have just been a bit of trivia. Or it could have ended his career and become remembered as one of the greatest disasters in film history. Knowing what you've learned so far about Jerry Lewis, would you believe that he was also the first person to make a mainstream movie about the Holocaust? A movie that has only ever been seen in its entirety by 12 people? Let's talk about The Day the Clown Cried. Content warning, as you can tell from the title, this episode discusses the Holocaust. There will be no more warnings beyond this point, so click away now or never. I'm Tor Parsons, this is my co-host Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. By the dawn of the 1970s, Jerry Lewis was like a human equivalent of Sue, the T-Rex skeleton in the Field Museum. Famous, worth a lot of money, ancient, fossilized, and millions of years past his prime. The studio era of Hollywood was giving way to a sophisticated new phase, driven not by the juggernaut studio system, but by a generation of young, independent-minded filmmakers with a vision. People with names you know. Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese. An era of legendary movies was around the corner. Movies that audiences loved and critics saw as great art. The Godfather, Jaws, The Graduate, Star Wars, Goncharov, American Graffiti, Taxi Driver, Apocalypse Now. Jerry Lewis had hit the peak of his popularity with The Nutty Professor less than 10 years before this, but his dumb comedies felt like they could have been 66 million years old. But the thing about Jerry Lewis is that he wasn't entirely a creature of the studio system. Under the studio system, it wasn't common for a single person to have as much creative control over a movie as Lewis usually did. Studios would hire a writer, a director, some actors, and some producers the way a construction company hires different kinds of workers for a job. Lewis was allowed to make all his own decisions on his movies because, through the early 60s, his movies were guaranteed moneymakers. Then came the social change of the later 60s, and Lewis wasn't alone anymore. The new Hollywood era was all about the individual director's vision. Studio movies were assembly line products. New Hollywood movies were meant to be seen as art. The movies Lewis made were quickly going out of style. But the way he made them was quickly coming into style. So Lewis did have a path to keeping his popularity alive. Goofy as his movies were, he was clearly a smart person who had his finger on the pulse of what Hollywood wanted, and by the mid-60s, he knew what Hollywood wanted wasn't him. In 1965, he left his longtime studio, Paramount, and attempted to gradually ease into more dramatic roles. The first movie he directed after leaving Paramount, 1966's Three on a Couch, was still a comedy, but Lewis's character wasn't quite one of the bumbling buffoons he was famous for playing. Three on a Couch was a dud with critics, though, and Lewis spent the next few years adrift in showbiz, making appearances on various other comedians' late-night shows and guest starring in sitcoms. And then, in 1971, he landed the role of a lifetime. He was going to star as a German clown who accidentally gets sent to a Nazi death camp. Once you've gotten past the basics, The Day the Clown Cried was a star vehicle for the slapstick comedian Jerry Lewis, in which he played a clown in Auschwitz. The first thing to know about The Day the Clown Cried is this. It was not a Holocaust movie. That was not a category yet in 1971. It was going to be the Holocaust movie. The first major movie to depict the death camps on screen. The Holocaust was not a widespread topic of discussion in early 1970s America. People knew that it had happened, and there had already been widely watched documentaries made about it, but the term Holocaust itself wasn't in popular use. If it was taught in school, it would only have been as part of a broader unit on World War II, and it wouldn't have been afforded as much attention as, say, D-Day. Making a mass-market movie that really grappled with the events of the Holocaust was not something anyone wanted to undertake. Not until Jerry Lewis. The second thing to know about The Day the Clown Cried is that it wasn't originally Jerry Lewis's movie. The script had been written in the early 1960s by Joan O'Brien and Charles Denton, a pair of hangers-on from the outer circle of Los Angeles TV producers. Neither of them published another screenplay before or since, and neither of them were Jewish. A few sources claim The Day the Clown Cried was written by a different Joan O'Brien, an actress who co-starred with Lewis in a few light 50s comedies, but she was a different person with the same name who coincidentally had ties to Jerry Lewis. The original screenplay for The Day the Clown Cried was supposed to be grim and unsparing, with no comic elements whatsoever, but when Nathan Wachsberger, a small-time Belgian film producer, picked up Denton and O'Brien's script and attempted to make it into a movie, he began looking for a lead actor who was previously best known as a comedian. Milton Berle, Bobby Darin, and Dick Van Dyke all turned the role down, and when Wachsberger showed the script to Jerry Lewis, he, too, turned it down at first. Lewis wanted to establish himself as someone who could do dramatic roles, but this was a bridge too far. He suggested a classically trained actor like Laurence Olivier should be the lead instead. But according to Lewis's autobiography, he almost immediately changed his mind, saying, quote, "What a horror. It must be told." Jerry Lewis, who was himself Jewish, realized that someone had to make a mass-market movie about the Holocaust, and if nobody else was going to do it, somehow he, Jerry Lewis, the nutty professor, the ladies' man, the master of playing cross-eyed idiots, he was going to throw himself into this. And that's exactly what he did. As if he was directing one of his old slapstick movies, Lewis took complete creative control, establishing himself not only as the star, but as the director and co-writer, going through the script and changing whatever he wanted to. Here's where things start to get murky. It's widely reported that Lewis altered the script in the only way he knew how, adding comedy. The one change we clearly know about doesn't bode well for the others. Lewis changed the name of the lead character from Carl Schmidt to Helmut Dork. What was the overall tone of The Day the Clown Cried meant to be? Nobody is sure. One rather alarming data point is the cover for the script booklet that Lewis used on set, which shows a grotesque cartoon man laughing with the words, "A Family Film," next to it. Joan O'Brien, one of the original co-writers, disgustedly said that Lewis made her emotional epic into a Charlie Chaplin-style dark comedy. She had intended Carl Schmidt / Helmut Dork as a thoroughly unlikable person, while Lewis made him more sympathetic. In O'Brien's eyes, Lewis made the movie less about the Holocaust and more about Helmut Dork's redemption arc, with the death camps just there to add tension. But not everyone agrees with her. A French film critic who managed to watch a rough cut of The Day the Clown Cried said it's actually the most real portrayal of the Holocaust in fiction he'd ever seen. He said it was better than Schindler's List, usually considered the greatest work of fiction about the Holocaust. Let's put a pin in that. We'll get there later. From the plot summary of The Day the Clown Cried, I think that whether or not The Day the Clown Cried is a respectful portrayal of the Holocaust, Lewis did intend for it to be something else. An allegory for his own career. The story opens with the washed-up clown Helmut Dork, who is not Jewish in the story, looking back on better days. The year is 1940, and he used to be a famous performer, touring the world with the Ringling Brothers Circus, but times changed. He's working with a small-time circus in northern Germany, where he doesn't get the newer clown's style of comedy. He gets fired after he causes an accident during a show. Drinking to get his mind off his career, Helmut wonders, am I still funny? Was I ever funny? Do I even want to be funny anymore? And if I'm not funny, what am I? If I can't be a clown, am I anything at all? Helmut begins to vent about the state of the country and gets arrested for mocking Hitler in a bar. He gets sent to a concentration camp for political prisoners, though not before snitching on nearly everyone he knows for also disrespecting Hitler, on the assumption that it'll get him a lighter sentence. In the camp, Helmut tries to keep his spirits up by talking about his days as a successful clown, so his fellow inmates pressure him into performing for them. They're unimpressed, and they take their anger out on Helmut, beating him up for exaggerating his talent. When a trainload of Jewish children arrive at the camp, Helmut discovers that they think he's funny, at least, and he begins entertaining the kids through the barbed wire fence separating the Jewish prisoners from the political prisoners. He's relieved to finally find people who appreciate him as a comedian. The camp guards try to stop Helmut from befriending the Jews, but after several failed attempts, one of which results in Helmut's only friend in the political prisoners' camp being beaten to death, the guards employ Helmut as a sort of Pied Piper to lead children onto the trains to the death camps. Helmut accepts this because all he wants is an audience. By accident, he gets locked in a boxcar with the children and shipped to Auschwitz, where he willingly accompanies them into the gas chambers. The end. I doubt Lewis expected his career to end that way, at least I certainly hope not. But the thing that sticks out the most to me is that Helmut Dork is Jerry Lewis. When Lewis signed on to this project, he didn't just want to portray the main character, he wanted the main character to portray him. In the final version of the script, The Day the Clown Cried wasn't about the Holocaust. It was about the decline and fall of Jerry Lewis. He seemed to be saying, metaphorically, obviously, that if he didn't manage to pivot to serious films, he'd end up like Helmut Dork. And Lewis definitely acted like his career depended on the movie being a success. He traveled to Poland and toured the death camps, sold his Vancouver Island vacation home to free up more money for the budget, and adopted a diet that lost him 35 pounds in order to convincingly play a concentration camp inmate. Some sources report that he ate nothing but grapefruit, but I think that's one of the many urban legends that has grown up around this movie. The filming was to take place in Sweden, with a mostly Swedish cast, which posed problems for the actors playing Jewish prisoners. Audiences were not expecting them to look like blonde, blue-eyed Swedes. The circus scenes from the beginning of the movie were shot in Paris. The movie was planned for a summer 1974 release date, and it even already had a stylized logo that appeared on the camera equipment and script booklets, consisting of the words, "The Day the Cried," with a picture of Lewis's face in clown makeup taking up the place of the word clown. So in other words, you could argue that the first use of emojis as we know them today was in the production of a lost Holocaust movie made by a slapstick comedian, but I think that's a factoid that is too psychotic even for Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Lewis successfully completed most of the filming, even as disasters piled up around him. He was suffering in the Scandinavian cold, struggling with a long-hidden opioid addiction that he wouldn't get clean from for several more years. Unrelatedly, Nathan Waxberger, the producer, turned out to be a slippery son of a bitch, and on the first day of production, he pocketed the funds intended for the movie and flew down to southern France, dropping off the radar. Lewis had to fund the rest of the production out of his pocket, and he wasn't exactly making a lot of money at this point in his career. And Lewis didn't even have the legal rights to release the movie as he was filming it. Waxberger had been trying to make the movie for so long, he'd let his rights to O'Brien and Denton's screenplay lapse. Waxberger owed O'Brien $50,000, now Lewis had to pay that. Even though Lewis had heavily reimagined the script, O'Brien was still a credited co-writer. And since Waxberger never paid her to renew his rights, she owned the script. And neither Lewis nor Waxberger did. And even if none of the chaos behind the scenes had taken place, The Day the Clown Cried still wouldn't have been in great shape. An absurd, awful, unbelievable rumor was starting to spread through Hollywood. Jerry Lewis is making a movie about the Holocaust. Critics' knives were out. In an uncomfortable parallel to the scene in The Day the Clown Cried where Helmut Dork is beaten up by his fellow prisoners for not being as funny as he claims, other comedians were throwing Lewis under the bus. Even before production wrapped on The Day the Clown Cried, there was a lot of negative buzz about it. In one of the few interviews Lewis allowed around that time, he put a brave face on it, saying that all the adversity he faced while making The Day the Clown Cried made his first dramatic performance more convincing, telling the New York Times, "I put all the pain on the screen." But there was more pain still to come. In desperation, Lewis offered to pay O'Brien for the rights to the story, even though he was on the edge of financial ruin. Waxberger had stiffed the Stockholm production studio of $600,000, which would be $4.26 million today. As rich and successful as Lewis had been less than 10 years before, he couldn't pay that out of pocket. He couldn't come close. Worse, when O'Brien saw a rough cut of the movie, she said she hated it, and declared that no amount of money could ever make her fork over the rights to this movie. That was the last word. When O'Brien died in 2004, she still owned the copyright to The Day the Clown Cried, and as long as she lived, she refused to let anyone see the movie. Over the next few years, Lewis came over to her side. He, too, began to believe that The Day the Clown Cried was unfit for a public release, that it had been a disaster all along, and everyone should just forget it ever existed. For the remaining 45 years of his life, whenever anyone brought up The Day the Clown Cried in an interview, Lewis would get angry and refuse to answer any questions. He kept a rough cut on videotape in a suitcase in his LA office, believed to be the most complete cut of The Day the Clown Cried in existence, and he even showed it for a few of his closest friends over the years, but he steadfastly refused to release it, even in the unlikely event that he could wrestle the story rights away from O'Brien. And so, by making The Day the Clown Cried, Lewis had made it come true. For a while, it looked like his career really had gone into the gas chamber, and that Helmut Dork's life as a sad, talentless clown just trying to recreate the magic of the bygone days when he was a star would be Jerry Lewis's life too. He didn't make any more movies for another 10 years. Once he finally overcame his drug issues and staged a return to the big screen, though, it was clear he hadn't really gotten over The Day the Clown Cried. Pieces of it popped up in his final successful run of movies throughout the 1980s. In 1981's Hardly Working, his first commercially released movie since 1970, he starred as a clown who had been laid off by a circus and questioned whether he could still be funny. A clear echo of Helmut Dork, even though Hardly Working took that premise and made it into a plotless comedy along the lines of Lewis's 60s output. The next year, none other than Martin Scorsese cast him in the psychological thriller The King of Comedy, in which Lewis finally realized his longtime dream of doing a well-received dramatic performance. Like in The Day the Clown Cried, he was doing a serious role in which he played a comedian. And, like in Day the Clown Cried, Lewis was sort of playing himself, albeit a very different version of himself. His character in The King of Comedy is a famous and stuck-up late-night comedian, who the movie's main character has an unhealthy obsession with. The King of Comedy is quite good, a really underrated Scorsese movie, and clearly I'm not the only person who thinks that, because the divisive 2019 Joker movie, possibly the world's second most controversial sad clown movie, is pretty much a stealth remake of it. Same story with the Joker in it. But even with Lewis getting acting awards for his performance in The King of Comedy, the first time he'd ever been nominated for most of the awards he got, it was still a totally insane bit of trivia among film buffs that he had once tried to make a Holocaust movie. Seeing a comedian playing the role of a comedian in a serious movie made sense, especially when the director was someone as respected as Scorsese. The idea of Jerry Lewis writing and directing and starring in a movie about the fucking Holocaust was miles away, and the cultural mystique of The Day the Clown Cried grew and grew, especially as Lewis refused point blank to talk about it. Some people questioned whether the movie had really existed or if it was just an urban legend, like, say, Orson Welles' Batman movie, which is a long-lasting Hollywood myth with no basis in reality. The whole twisted story of The Day the Clown Cried was brought to a wider audience in a 1992 article in Spy magazine, which included what is still probably the best-known quote about the movie. They tracked down 8 people who had been allowed to see The Day the Clown Cried, one of whom was Harry Shearer, a comedian who played the bassist in Spinal Tap and voices Mr. Burns, Ned Flanders, and a few other recurring characters on The Simpsons. Shearer had this to say about The Day the Clown Cried. With most of these kinds of things, you find that the anticipation, or the concept, is better than the thing itself. But seeing this film was really awe-inspiring, in that you are rarely in the presence of a perfect object. This was a perfect object. This movie is so drastically wrong. Its pathos and its comedy are so wildly misplaced that you could not, in your fantasy of what it might be like, improve on what it really is. Oh my god, that's all you can say. It's as if you flew down to Tijuana and suddenly saw a painting on black velvet of Auschwitz. You'd think, my god, wait a minute. It's not funny, and it's not good, and somebody's trying too hard in the wrong direction to convey this strongly held feeling. This has been the last word on The Day the Clown Cried ever since. It's not just awful, it's legendarily awful. As tasteless as the words Jerry Lewis Holocaust movie sound, the real movie is even more tasteless than that. You could call that the orthodox opinion on The Day the Clown Cried. The other 7 people interviewed in the Spy magazine article nitpicked other things about the movie that made it sound ridiculous. Supposedly, there's a scene where Lewis is wearing brand new shoes and has slicked back hair after being in the concentration camp for years. But a handful of other people have been allowed to see The Day the Clown Cried over the years, and not everyone agrees it was a disaster. In fact, a few people have even suggested it was ahead of its time, and if it had been released later into a media world that had shed its existing baggage of who Jerry Lewis was, it could have won Lewis an Oscar. Is it possible that The Day the Clown Cried is good? As Mark Twain said, history never repeats, but it often rhymes. In the mid-1990s, Roberto Benigni, was something of the Italian Jerry Lewis. He had become a household name in Italy with a long string of high-concept, low-on-plot comedies that he wrote, directed, and starred in, and was known for his wacky, often rude antics on Italian TV, such as singing a fake Catholic hymn about the joy of shitting yourself, and an incident where he called the Pope something that doesn't really translate into English, but from the reaction, I think it was kind of like that minor scandal where a black comedian called Obama the N-word in like a friendly and casual way. So, those kinds of things were what Benigni was known for. And Benigni wasn't Jewish. There was no way he could make a Holocaust movie. And then he did. And it became the biggest hit the Italian film industry had ever seen. You might have heard of it. The name of this movie was Life is Beautiful. Whether or not The Day the Clown Cried was intended as comedy, Life is Beautiful definitely is. The first half of Life is Beautiful is a slapstick comedy. Benigni's character Guido, a bumbling moron who incidentally happens to be Jewish, is trying to win the heart of Dora, a Catholic girl, in a small town in 1930s Italy. Mussolini is in power, but that's in the background. Through a series of carefully arranged accidents, Dora begins to fall for Guido, culminating in a chaotic horseback chase in which he snatches Dora away from the clutches of the anti-Semitic politician she had previously been arranged to marry. So far, so formulaic. It seems like the only reason Guido is Jewish is to set up a forbidden romance angle. Skip ahead a few years. It's 1944. Most of Italy is under the control of the Salo Republic, a Nazi puppet state. Guido and Dora have a young son, Josue, who Guido is gradually trying to teach about the world, a difficult task because he's also trying to shield Josue from the real horrors of the world. When the two of them are captured and sent on a train to a concentration camp, Guido is forced to pretend that it's all a game for Josue and that everything is really under control. Guido and Josue escape death by a few lucky accidents, and Josue continues to believe that he's in a sort of game show simulation, where if he stays quiet and never complains, he'll eventually win a real-life tank. At the end, as the camp is liberated, Guido gets shot by the guards, and Josue is beginning to wonder if the whole thing really is a game after all, when an American tank bursts through the gates of the camp. Josue erupts in celebration. He won. Life is Beautiful can only be described as a feel-good slapstick Holocaust comedy. And yes, it was controversial when it came out in 1997 for that reason. But the thing is, Life is Beautiful wasn't as controversial as you might expect. Most critics agreed that Benigni had been respectful in his portrayal and had managed the impossible. Making a movie that mixed humor and the Holocaust without being tasteless, Life is Beautiful became the highest-grossing Italian movie ever, the second-highest-grossing foreign movie in America ever, got a nomination for Best Picture, rare for a movie not in English, and even won Benigni an Oscar for Best Actor, the first win for someone in a non-English-speaking role. Benigni accepted the award in true slapstick style, leaping across the rows of seats and pushing people aside to get to the stage. And a few critics pointed out that Benigni wasn't the first person to attempt a movie like this. Life is Beautiful is very similar to The Day the Clown Cried. A goofy man is faced with the unspeakable seriousness of the Holocaust, and he responds by trying to lighten the mood in the camps. In the end, things don't turn out well for him, but he has inspired children to laugh in the face of tragedy. And it turned out that Life is Beautiful was a good movie. Could the same be true of The Day the Clown Cried? And yet, I think the comparisons between The Day the Clown Cried and Life is Beautiful aren't quite accurate. I've read Jerry Lewis's script for The Day the Clown Cried, which is easily accessible online. I don't see any humor in it. In fact, it's incredibly sad. If there's anything funny about it, it's a rueful sense of shaking your head at poor Helmut Dork. It's funny in the way the book Candide is funny. It's funny because the things that happen to the main character are over-the-top horrible. According to the people who have seen it, Lewis's character does try to entertain people in the movie with the typical fake clumsiness and physical gags everyone knew Lewis for, but the audience isn't supposed to think it's funny. In fact, that's the point. Most of The Day the Clown Cried's appeal has come from its reputation as a lost slapstick comedy about the Holocaust. But the really crazy thing about The Day the Clown Cried is that, if Life is Beautiful is any indication, The Day the Clown Cried probably would have been better, if that's what it was. The Day the Clown Cried is something far weirder than that. A lost, viscerally sad drama about the Holocaust, 100% played straight, made by slapstick comedian Jerry Lewis. The Day the Clown Cried came back into the discourse after Life is Beautiful. The most vigorous defenders of it were, unsurprisingly, the French. Jean-Michel Frodon, one of France's top film critics, saw a rough cut in the early 2000s and said he loved it, but he didn't compare it to Life is Beautiful. He compared it to Schindler's List, saying The Day the Clown Cried was actually a much more real portrayal of the Holocaust, because at the end of The Day the Clown Cried, everyone dies. Whereas the main plot of Schindler's List follows 1,200 Jews who escape. His position seems to be, The Day the Clown Cried is about 6 million people who died. Schindler's List is about 1,200 who didn't. Only one of those is an accurate portrayal of the Holocaust. So, Frodon defends the idea that The Day the Clown Cried is not funny at all, and that's what makes it good. Which is a very French take on the whole thing. The Europeans have a much more finely tuned appetite for despair than us cheerful, gung-ho Americans. Today, everyone who knows about The Day the Clown Cried seems to allow that it could be good, and the conversation around the movie seems to split along the lines of, if it's a comedy, it's tasteless and awful. If it's a drama, it's probably great cinema. I'd argue that it's the other way around. Jerry Lewis could have made a decent movie like Life is Beautiful, but there's not much indication that he meant it that way. Ultimately, most of the claims that The Day the Clown Cried was a comedy come down to the fact that Jerry Lewis was in it. What Jerry Lewis probably did was make a movie like Schindler's List, and he was not the right man for that. Is that too hard to believe? Jerry Lewis knew comedy. He did not know drama. He'd tried to get a foot in the door in the world of drama, and if he'd started smaller, he could've. The King of Comedy showed that he can put in a good dramatic performance, but to try writing, directing, and starring in a movie about the Holocaust as his first dramatic feature is like deciding one day to take up hiking and immediately jetting off to Nepal to climb Mount Everest. Of course it was going to fail. Especially since, I think all the signs point to him trying to make it an allegory for his own career, too. Jerry Lewis's first dramatic movie wasn't just about the Holocaust. It was about being Jerry Lewis's first dramatic movie. It was a midlife crisis movie, literally. He can't have known it at the time, but Lewis produced The Day the Clown Cried at exactly the halfway point of his life, down to the month. If it had been released, and met with confusion, as I'm pretty sure it would, I'm certain Lewis would have gone on the press circuit saying, "Can't you see? I'm Helmut Dork! I'm the one who needs to face up to the tragedies of the world because I'm not funny anymore! It's autobiographical!" And then, of course, The Day the Clown Cried would be remembered as the movie where Jerry Lewis used the Holocaust as a metaphor for the declining popularity of slapstick comedy. Maybe then there is a small mercy in the way The Day the Clown Cried really did get remembered. Of course, the only way to settle the question, what is the tone of Jerry Lewis's Holocaust movie, once and for all, is to find it and watch it. And what chance do we have of that? Sadly, not much of one. A few breathless media reports claimed that the whole thing will be revealed to the public in 2024, but as of the recording of this episode, there's 2 weeks left in 2024, and it's not out yet. This rumor stems from a collection of film reel negatives Lewis sent to the Library of Congress in 2014, under the stipulation that it wouldn't be released for 10 years, correctly guessing that he'd be dead by then. The reels were shown for a few film critics last summer, but they lacked sound, hadn't been edited, and were mostly behind-the-scenes footage. What's more, Joan O'Brien's descendants claim to still own the copyright for the movie, and they have insinuated they might sue if anyone tries to release any part of it. When a German documentary in 2016 showed bits and pieces of The Day the Clown Cried, many of which were rough and lacked sound, any attempt at posting just the clips from the movie online resulted in a copyright strike. There are other people who might have pieces of it. Remember, Lewis had a suitcase containing his own rough cut of The Day the Clown Cried on videotape. Where the suitcase went in Lewis's later years is unknown, but in the 2000s, the French director Xavier Yanoli was reported to have a videotape of, quote, the most complete version, strongly implying it was the same tape. Yanoli may still have it, but if he does, he isn't interested in answering questions about it. The Swedish studio, where The Day the Clown Cried was produced, has some negatives, but not a complete film either. In the late 80s and early 90s, Lewis briefly flirted with the idea of shooting a remake of it, potentially starring Robin Williams, but the ongoing copyright issues kept that idea in the ground, and Lewis quickly went back to his usual position of, nobody should ever see this movie. And you know what? By that point, I think that had become a calculated move. Jerry Lewis's movies were all about leaving the audience guessing. At its very essence, a joke is when you expect something in particular and you get something else. Lewis was admired for the effort he put into his gags, but the best gag he ever pulled was pulling The Day the Clown Cried from release. I mean, if you hear anyone talking about Jerry Lewis today, outside of France, I guess, it's much more likely to be about The Day the Clown Cried than any of his successful comedies. You can't blame Jerry Lewis for not being funny to us in the 21st century. Humor is rarely immortal. I think our standard of what's considered funny changes way faster than most other elements of culture. For every best gorilla joke of 1897, there's a million Nutty Professors. And yeah, I know the best gorilla joke of 1897 isn't really from 1897. That's my point. By creating one of Hollywood's most enduring mysteries and taking it with him to the grave, Jerry Lewis made sure that he would never be forgotten. While the rest of his humor may not have withstood the test of time, you have to admit that Lewis had the last laugh.